Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
At Kroger Pharmacy, care is what's most convenient for you. Care is being here when you need us. We're open evenings and weekends. Care is helping you save more. Most insurance plans and discount cards are accepted at your local Kroger Pharmacy. Care is saving you time by managing your prescriptions online. You can request refills, check order status, and more. Care is convenience that works for everyone. Kroger Health, a world of care is in store. Services and availability vary by location. Age and other restrictions may apply. For coverage, consult your health insurance company. Visit the pharmacy or our site for details.
Book 1, Chapter 6 of Michael Strogoff, Courier of the Tsar. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Michael Strogoff by Jules Verne. Book 1, Chapter 6. Brother and Sister. However disastrous these measures might be to private interests, they were, under the circumstances, perfectly justifiable.
All Russian subjects are forbidden to leave the province.
If Ivan Ogareff was still in the province, this would at any rate prevent him, unless with the greatest difficulty, from rejoining Feofar Khan and becoming a very formidable lieutenant to the Tartar chief.
All foreigners of Asiatic origin are ordered to leave the province in 24 hours.
This would send off in a body all the traders from Central Asia, as well as the bands of Bohemians, Gypsies, etc., having more or less sympathy with the Tartars. So many heads, so many spies, undoubtedly affairs required their expulsion. It is easy to understand the effect produced by these two thunderclaps bursting over a town like Nizhny Novgorod, so densely crowded with visitors, and with a commerce so greatly surpassing that of all other places in Russia. The natives whom business called beyond the Siberian frontier could not leave the province for a time at least. The tenor of the first article of the order was express. It admitted of no exception. All private interests must yield to the public weal. As to the second article of the proclamation, the order of expulsion which it contained admitted of no evasion either. It only concerned foreigners of Asiatic origin, but these could do nothing but pack up their merchandise and go back the way they came. As to the mountebanks, of which there were a considerable number, they had nearly 1,000 versts to go before they could reach the nearest frontier. For them it was simply misery. At first there rose against this unusual measure a murmur of protestation, a cry of despair, but this was quickly suppressed by the presence of the Cossacks and agents of police. Immediately what might be called the exodus from the immense plain began. The awnings in front of the stalls were folded up, the theatres were taken to pieces, the fires were put out, the acrobats' ropes were lowered, the old broken-winded horses of the travelling vans came back from their sheds. Agents and soldiers with whip or stick stimulated the tardy ones, and made nothing of pulling down the tents even before the poor Bohemians had left them. Under these energetic measures the square of Nizhny Novgorod would, it was evident, be entirely evacuated before the evening, and to the tumult of the great fair would succeed the silence of the desert. It must again be repeated, for it was a necessary aggravation of these severe measures, that to all those nomads chiefly concerned in the order of expulsion, even the steppes of Siberia were forbidden, and they would be obliged to hasten to the south of the Caspian Sea, either to Persia, Turkey, or the plains of Turkestan. The post of the Ural, and the mountains which form, as it were, a prolongation of the river along the Russian frontier, they were not allowed to pass. They were therefore under the necessity of travelling 600 miles before they could tread a free soil. Just as the reading of the proclamation by the head of the police came to an end, an idea darted instinctively into the mind of Michael Strogoff. "What a singular coincidence," thought he, between this proclamation expelling all foreigners of Asiatic origin and the words exchanged last evening between those two gypsies of the Zingari race.
"The father himself sends us where we wish to go," that old man said.
"But the father is the emperor. He is never called anything else among the people. How could those gypsies have foreseen the measure taken against them? How could they have known it beforehand, and where do they wish to go? Those are suspicious people, and it seems to me that to them the government proclamation must be more useful than injurious."
But these reflections were completely dispelled by another which drove every other thought out of Michael's mind. He forgot the Zingaris, their suspicious words, the strange coincidence which resulted from the proclamation. The remembrance of the young Livonian girl suddenly rushed into his mind. "Poor child," he thought to himself, "she cannot now cross the frontier." In truth, the young girl was from Riga. She was Livonian, consequently Russian, and now could not leave Russian territory. The permit which had been given her before the new measures had been promulgated was no longer available. All the routes to Siberia had just been pitilessly closed to her, and, whatever the motive taking her to Irkutsk, she was now forbidden to go there. This thought greatly occupied Michael Strogoff. He said to himself, vaguely at first, that, without neglecting anything of what was due to his important mission, it would perhaps be possible for him to be of some use to this brave girl, and this idea pleased him. Knowing how serious were the dangers which he, an energetic and vigorous man, would have personally to encounter, he could not conceal from himself how infinitely greater they would prove to a young, unprotected girl. As she was going to Irkutsk, she would be obliged to follow the same road as himself. She would have to pass through the bands of invaders, as he was about to attempt doing himself. If, moreover, she had at her disposal only the money necessary for a journey taken under ordinary circumstances, how could she manage to accomplish it under conditions which made it not only perilous but expensive? "Well," said he, "if she takes the route to Perm, it is nearly impossible but that I shall fall in with her. Then I will watch over her without her suspecting it, and as she appears to me as anxious as myself to reach Irkutsk, she will cause me no delay." But one thought leads to another. Michael Strogoff had till now thought only of doing a kind action. But now another idea flashed into his brain. The question presented itself under quite a new aspect.
"The fact is," said he to himself, "that I have much more need of her than she can have of me. Her presence will be useful in drawing off suspicion from me. A man traveling alone across the steppe may be easily guessed to be a courier of the Tsar. If, on the contrary, this young girl accompanies me, I shall appear, in the eyes of all, the Nicholas Korpanov of my Podorojna. Therefore she must accompany me. Therefore I must find her again at any cost. It is not probable that since yesterday evening she has been able to get a carriage and leave Nizhny Novgorod. I must look for her, and may God guide me." Michael left the great square of Nizhny Novgorod, where the tumult produced by the carrying out of the prescribed measures had now reached its height. Recriminations from the banished strangers, shouts from the agents and Cossacks who were using them so brutally, together made an indescribable uproar. The girl for whom he searched could not be there. It was now 9 o'clock in the morning. The steamboat did not start till 12. Michael Strogoff had therefore nearly 2 hours to employ in searching for her whom he wished to make his traveling companion. He crossed the Volga again and hunted through the quarters on the other side, where the crowd was much less considerable. He entered the churches, the natural refuge for all who weep, for all who suffer. Nowhere did he meet with the young Livonian. "And yet," he repeated, "she could not have left Nizhny Novgorod yet. We'll have another look." He wandered about thus for 2 hours. He went on without stopping, feeling no fatigue, obeying a potent instinct which allowed no room for thought. All was in vain. It then occurred to him that perhaps the girl had not heard of the order, though this was improbable enough, for such a thunderclap could not have burst without being heard by all. Evidently interested in knowing the smallest news from Siberia, how could she be ignorant of the measures taken by the governor, measures which concerned her so directly?
But, if she was ignorant of it, she would come in an hour to the quay, and there some merciless agent would refuse her a passage. At any cost, he must see her beforehand, and enable her to avoid such a repulse. But all his endeavors were in vain, and he at last almost despaired of finding her again. It was 11 o'clock, and Michael thought of presenting his podorojna at the office of the head of police. The proclamation evidently did not concern him, since the emergency had been foreseen for him, but he wished to make sure that nothing would hinder his departure from the town. Michael then returned to the other side of the Volga, to the quarter in which was the office of the head of police. An immense crowd was collected there, for though all foreigners were ordered to quit the province, they had, notwithstanding, to go through certain forms before they could depart. Without this precaution, some Russian more or less implicated in the Tartar movement would have been able, in a disguise, to pass the frontier, just those whom the order wished to prevent going. The strangers were sent away, but still had to gain permission to go. Mountebanks, gypsies, Tsiganis, Zingaris, mingled with merchants from Persia, Turkey, India, Turkestan, China, filled the court and offices of the police station. Everyone was in a hurry, for the means of transport would be much sought after among this crowd of banished people, and those who did not set about it soon ran the great risk of not being able to leave the town in the prescribed time, which would expose them to some brutal treatment from the governor's agents. Owing to the strength of his elbows, Michael was able to cross the court. But to get into the office and up to the clerk's little window was a much more difficult business. However, a word into an inspector's ear and a few judiciously given rubles were powerful enough to gain him a passage. The man, after taking him into the waiting room, went to call an upper clerk. Michael Strogoff would not be long in making everything right with the police and being free in his movements. While waiting, he looked about him, and what did he see? There, fallen, rather than seated, on a bench, was a girl, prey to a silent despair, although her face could scarcely be seen, the profile alone being visible against the wall. Michael Strogoff could not be mistaken. He instantly recognized the young Livonian. Not knowing the governor's orders, she had come to the police office to get her pass signed. They had refused to sign it. No doubt she was authorized to go to Irkutsk, but the order was peremptory. It annulled all previous authorizations, and the routes to Siberia were closed to her. Michael, delighted at having found her again, approached the girl. She looked up for a moment, and her face brightened on recognizing her traveling companion. She instinctively rose, and, like a drowning man who clutches at a spar, she was about to ask his help. At that moment the agent touched Michael on the shoulder. "The head of police will see you," he said. "Good," returned Michael, and without saying a word to her for whom he had been searching all day, without reassuring her by even a gesture, which might compromise either her or himself, he followed the man. The young Livonian, seeing the only being to whom she could look for help disappear, fell back again on her bench. 3 minutes had not passed before Michael Strogoff reappeared, accompanied by the agent. In his hand he held his podorojna, which threw open the roads to Siberia for him. He again approached the young Livonian, and holding out his hand, "Sister," said he. She understood. She rose as if some sudden inspiration prevented her from hesitating a moment. "Sister," repeated Michael Strogoff, "we are authorized to continue our journey to Irkutsk. Will you come with me?"
"I will follow you, brother," replied the girl, putting her hand into that of Michael Strogoff.
And together they left the police station. End of Book 1, Chapter 6. Book 1, Chapter 7 of Michael Strogoff, Courier of the Tsar. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Michael Strogoff by Jules Verne. Book 1, Chapter 7. Going Down the Volga. A little before midday, the steamboat's bell drew to the wharf on the Volga an unusually large concourse of people, for not only were those about to embark who had intended to go,
but the many who were compelled to go contrary to their wishes. The boilers of the Caucasus were under full pressure. A slight smoke issued from its funnel, whilst the end of the escape pipe and the lids of the valves were crowned with white vapor. It is needless to say that the police kept a close watch over the departure of the Caucasus, and showed themselves pitiless to those travelers who did not satisfactorily answer their questions. Numerous Cossacks came and went on the quay, ready to assist the agents, but they had not to interfere, as no one ventured to offer the slightest resistance to their orders. Exactly at the hour the last clang of the bell sounded, the powerful wheels of the steamboat began to beat the water, and the Caucasus passed rapidly between the two towns of which Nizhny Novgorod is composed. Michael Strogoff and the young Livonian had taken passage on board the Caucasus. Their embarkation was made without any difficulty. As is known, the Podorojna, drawn up in the name of Nicholas Korpanov, authorized this merchant to be accompanied on his journey to Siberia. They appeared, therefore, to be a brother and sister traveling under the protection of the Imperial Police. Both, seated together at the stern, gazed at the receding town, so disturbed by the governor's order. Michael had as yet said nothing to the girl. He had not even questioned her. He waited until she should speak to him, when that was necessary. She had been anxious to leave the town, in which, but for the providential intervention of this unexpected protector, she would have remained imprisoned. She said nothing, but her looks spoke her thanks. The Volga, the Ra of the ancients, the largest river in all Europe, is almost 3,000 miles in length. Its waters, rather unwholesome in its upper part, are improved at Nizhny Novgorod by those of the Oka, a rapid affluent, issuing from the central provinces of Russia. The system of Russian canals and rivers has been justly compared to a gigantic tree whose branches spread over every part of the empire. The Volga forms the trunk of this tree, and it has for roots 70 mouths opening into the Caspian Sea. It is navigable as far as Rijeff, a town in the government of Tver, that is, along the greater part of its course. The steamboats plying between Perm and Nizhny Novgorod rapidly perform the 250 miles which separate this town from the town of Kazan. It is true that these boats have only to descend the Volga, which adds nearly 2 miles of current per hour to their own speed, but on arriving at the confluence of the Kama, a little below Kazan, they are obliged to quit the Volga for the smaller river, up which they ascend to Perm. Powerful as were her machines, the Caucasus could not thus, after entering the Kama, make against the current more than 10 miles an hour. Including an hour's stoppage at Kazan, the voyage from Nizhny Novgorod to Perm would take from between 60 to 62 hours. The steamer was very well arranged, and the passengers, according to their condition or resources, occupied 3 distinct classes on board. Michael Strogoff had taken care to engage 2 first-class cabins, so that his young companion might retire into hers whenever she liked. The Caucasus was loaded with passengers of every description. A number of Asiatic traders had thought it best to leave Nizhny Novgorod immediately. In that part of the steamer reserved for the first class might be seen Armenians in long robes and a sort of mitre on their heads, Jews, known by their conical caps, rich Chinese in their traditional costume, a very wide blue, violet, or black robe, Turks wearing the national turban, Hindus with square caps, and a simple string for a girdle, some of which hold in their hands all the traffic of Central Asia, and lastly Tartars wearing boots ornamented with many-colored braid and the breast a mass of embroidery. All these merchants had been obliged to pile up their numerous bales and chests in the hold and on the deck, and the transport of their baggage would cost them dear, for according to the regulations, each person had only a right to 20 pounds weight. In the bows of the Caucasus were more numerous groups of passengers, not only foreigners, but also Russians, who were not forbidden by the order to go back to their towns in the province. There were mujiks with caps on their heads and wearing checked shirts under their wide pelisses, peasants of the Volga, with blue trousers stuffed into their boots, rose-colored cotton shirts, drawn in by a cord, felt caps,
A few women, habited in flowery patterned cotton dresses, gay-colored aprons, and bright handkerchiefs on their heads. These were principally third-class passengers, who were, happily, not troubled by the prospect of a long return voyage. The Caucasus passed numerous boats being towed up the stream, carrying all sorts of merchandise to Nizhny Novgorod, then passed rafts of wood interminably long, and barges loaded to the gunwale, and nearly sinking under water. A bootless voyage they were making, since the fair had been abruptly broken up at its outset. The waves caused by the steamer splashed on the banks, covered with flocks of wild duck, who flew away uttering deafening cries. A little farther, on the dry fields, bordered with willows and aspens, were scattered a few cows, sheep, and herds of pigs. Fields, sown with thin buckwheat and rye, stretched away to a background of half-cultivated hills, offering no remarkable prospect. The pencil of an artist in quest of the picturesque would have found nothing to reproduce in this monotonous landscape. The Caucasus had been steaming on for almost 2 hours, when the young Livonian, addressing herself to Michael, said,
"Are you going to Irkutsk, brother?"
"Yes, sister," answered the young man, "we are going the same way. Consequently, where I go, you shall go."
"Tomorrow, brother, you shall know why I left the shores of the Baltic to go beyond the Ural Mountains."
"I ask you nothing, sister."
"You shall know all," replied the girl, with a faint smile. "A sister should hide nothing from her brother, but I cannot today. Fatigue and sorrow have broken me."
"Will you go and rest in your cabin?" asked Michael Strogoff.
"Yes, yes, and tomorrow. Come then."
He hesitated to finish his sentence, as if he had wished to end it by the name of his companion, of which he was still ignorant.
"Nadia," said she,
holding out her hand.
"Come, Nadia," answered Michael, "and make what use you like of your brother Nicholas Korpanov."
And he led the girl to the cabin engaged for her off the saloon. Michael Strogoff returned on deck, and eager for any news which might bear on his journey, he mingled in the groups of passengers, though without taking any part in the conversation. Should he by any chance be questioned and obliged to reply, he would announce himself as the merchant Nicholas Korpanov, going back to the frontier, for he did not wish it to be suspected that a special permission authorized him to travel to Siberia. The foreigners in the steamer could evidently speak of nothing but the occurrences of the day, of the order and its consequences. These poor people, scarcely recovered from the fatigue of a journey across Central Asia, found themselves obliged to return, and if they did not give loud vent to their anger and despair, it was because they dared not. Fear, mingled with respect, restrained them. It was possible that inspectors of police, charged with watching the passengers, had secretly embarked on board the Caucasus, and it was just as well to keep silence. Expulsion, after all, was a good deal preferable to imprisonment in a fortress. Therefore the men were either silent, or spoke with so much caution that it was scarcely possible to get any useful information. Michael Strogoff thus could learn nothing here, but if mouths were often shut at his approach, for they did not know him, his ears were soon struck by the sound of one voice, which cared little whether it was heard or not. The man with the hearty voice spoke Russian, but with a French accent, and another speaker answered him more reservedly.
"What?" said the first. "Are you on board this boat too, my dear fellow? You whom I met at the Imperial Fete in Moscow, and just caught a glimpse of at Nizhny Novgorod?"
"Yes, it's I," answered the second dryly.
"Really, I didn't expect to be so closely followed."
"I am not following you, sir. I am preceding you."
"Proceed, proceed. Let us march abreast, keeping step like two soldiers on parade, and for the time at least, let us agree, if you will, that one shall not pass the other."
"On the contrary, I shall pass you."
"We shall see that when we are at the seat of war, but till then, why, let us be travelling companions. Later we shall have both time and occasion to be rivals."
"Enemies."
"Enemies, if you like. There is a precision in your words, my dear fellow, particularly agreeable to me. One may always know what one has to look for with you."
"What is the harm?"
"No harm at all. So in my turn, I will ask your permission to state our respective situations."
"State away."
You are going to Perm, like me?
Like you.
And probably you will go from Perm to Ekaterinburg, since that is the best and safest route by which to cross the Ural Mountains?
Probably.
Once past the frontier, we shall be in Siberia. That is to say, in the midst of the invasion.
We shall be there.
Well, then and only then will be the time to say, each for himself, and God for
me.
For you or by yourself. Very well. But since we have a week of neutral days before us, and since it is very certain that news will not shower upon us on the way, let us be friends until we become rivals again.
Enemies.
That's right, yes, that's right, enemies. But till then, let us act together, and not try and ruin each other. All the same, I promise you to keep to myself all that I can see,
and I all that I can hear.
Is that agreed?
It is agreed.
Your hand?
Here it is. And the hand of the first speaker, that is to say, five wide-open fingers, vigorously shook the two fingers coolly extended by the other.
By the by, said the first, I was able this morning to telegraph the very words of the order to my cousin at 10:17.
And I sent it to the Daily Telegraph at 10:13.
Bravo, Mr. Blanc.
Very good, Monsieur Jolivet.
I will try and match that.
It will be difficult.
I can try, however.
So saying, the French correspondent familiarly saluted the Englishman, who bowed stiffly. The governor's proclamation did not concern these two news-hunters, as they were neither Russians nor foreigners of Asiatic origin. However, being urged by the same instinct, they had left Nizhny Novgorod together. It was natural that they should take the same means of transport, and that they should follow the same route to the Siberian steppes. Traveling companions, whether enemies or friends, they had a week to pass together before the hunt would be open. And then success to the most expert. Alcide Jolivet had made the first advances, and Harry Blount had accepted them, though he had done so coldly. That very day at dinner the Frenchman, open as ever and even too loquacious, the Englishman still silent and grave, were seen hobnobbing at the same table, drinking genuine Cliquot, at 6 rubles the bottle, made from the fresh sap of the birch trees of the country. On hearing them chatting away together, Michael Strogoff said to himself,
"Those are inquisitive and indiscreet fellows whom I shall probably meet again on the way. It will be prudent for me to keep them at a distance."
The young Livonian did not come to dinner. She was asleep in her cabin, and Michael did not like to awaken her. It was evening before she reappeared on the deck of the Caucasus. The long twilight imparted a coolness to the atmosphere eagerly enjoyed by the passengers after the stifling heat of the day. As the evening advanced, the greater number never even thought of going into the saloon. Stretched on the benches, they inhaled with delight the slight breeze caused by the speed of the steamer. At this time of year, and under this latitude, the sky scarcely darkened between sunset and dawn, and left the steersman light enough to guide his steamer among the numerous vessels going up or down the Volga. Between 11 and 2, however, the moon being new, it was almost dark. Nearly all the passengers were then asleep on the deck, and the silence was disturbed only by the noise of the paddles striking the water at regular intervals. Anxiety kept Michael Strogoff awake. He walked up and down, but always in the stern of the steamer. Once, however, he happened to pass the engine room. He then found himself in the part reserved for second and third class passengers. There, everyone was lying asleep, not only on the benches, but also on the bales, packages, and even the deck itself. Some care was necessary not to tread on the sleepers, who were lying about everywhere. They were chiefly mujiks, accustomed to hard couches, and quite satisfied with the planks of the deck, but no doubt they would, all the same, have soundly abused the clumsy fellow who roused them with an accidental kick. Michael Strogoff took care, therefore, not to disturb anyone. By going thus to the end of the boat, he had no other idea but that of striving against sleep by a rather longer walk. He reached the forward deck, and was already climbing the forecastle ladder, when he heard someone speaking near him. He stopped. The voices appeared to come from a group of passengers enveloped in cloaks and wraps. It was impossible to recognize them in the dark, though it sometimes happened that, when the steamer's chimney sent forth a plume of ruddy flames, The sparks seemed to fall amongst the group as though thousands of spangles had been suddenly illuminated. Michael was about to step up the ladder when a few words reached his ear, uttered in that strange tongue which he had heard during the night at the fair. Instinctively he stopped to listen. Protected by the shadow of the forecastle, he could not be perceived himself. As to seeing the passengers who were talking, that was impossible. He must confine himself to listening. The first words exchanged were of no importance, to him at least, but they allowed him to recognize the voices of the man and woman whom he had heard at Nizhny Novgorod. This, of course, made him redouble his attention. It was, indeed, not at all impossible that these same Tsiganes, now banished, should be on board the Caucasus. And it was well for him that he listened, for he distinctly heard this question and answer made in the Tartar idiom.
"It is said that a courier has sent out from Moscow to Irkutsk."
"It is so said, Zangar, but either this courier will arrive too late, or he will not arrive at all."
Michael Strogoff started involuntarily at this reply, which concerned him so directly. He tried to see if the man and woman who had just spoken were really those whom he suspected, but he could not succeed. In a few moments, Michael Strogoff had regained the stern of the vessel without having been perceived, and taking a seat by himself, he buried his face in his hands. It might have been supposed that he was asleep. He was not asleep, however, and did not even think of sleeping. He was reflecting, not without a lively apprehension.
"Who is it that knows of my departure, and who can have any interest in knowing it?"
End of Book 1, Chapter 7. Book 1, Chapter 8 of Michael Strogoff, Courier of the Tsar. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Michael Strogoff by Jules Verne. Book 1, Chapter 8, Going Up the Kama. The next day, the 18th of July, at 7:20 in the morning, the Caucasus reached the Kasan Quay, 7 versts from the town. Kasan is situated at the confluence of the Volga and Kasanka. It is an important chief town of the government and a Greek archbishopric, as well as the seat of a university. The varied population preserves an Asiatic character. Although the town was so far from the landing place, a large crowd was collected on the quay. They had come for news. The governor of the province had published an order identical with that of Nizhny Novgorod. Police officers and a few Cossacks kept order among the crowd and cleared the way both for the passengers who were disembarking and also for those who were embarking on board the Caucasus, minutely examining both classes of travelers. The one were the Asiatics who were being expelled, the other, mujiks stopping at Kazan. Michael Strogoff unconcernedly watched the bustle which occurs at all quays on the arrival of a steam vessel. The Caucasus would stay for an hour to renew her fuel. Michael did not even think of landing. He was unwilling to leave the young Livonian girl alone on board, as she had not yet reappeared on deck. The two journalists had risen at dawn, as all good huntsmen should do. They went on shore and mingled with the crowd, each keeping to his own peculiar mode of proceeding. Harry Blount, sketching different types or noting some observation, Alcide Jolivet contenting himself with asking questions, confiding in his memory, which never failed him. There was a report along all the frontier that the insurrection and invasion had reached considerable proportions. Communication between Siberia and the Empire was already extremely difficult. All this Michael Strogoff heard from the new arrivals. This information could not but cause him great uneasiness, and increase his wish of being beyond the Ural Mountains, so as to judge for himself of the truth of these rumors, and enable him to guard against any possible contingency. He was thinking of seeking more direct intelligence from some native of Kasan, when his attention was suddenly diverted. Among the passengers who were leaving the Caucasus, Michael recognized the troop of Tsiganes, who, the day before, had appeared in the Nizhny Novgorod fair. There, on the deck of the steamboat, were the old Bohemian and the woman. With them, and no doubt under their direction, landed about 20 dancers and singers, from 15 to 20 years of age, wrapped in old cloaks which covered their spangled dresses.
These dresses, just then glancing in the first rays of the sun, reminded Michael of the curious appearance which he had observed during the night. It must have been the glitter of those spangles and the bright flames issuing from the steamboat's funnel which had attracted his attention. "Evidently," said Michael to himself, "this troop of Tsiganes, after remaining below all day, crouched under the forecastle during the night. Were these gypsies trying to show themselves as little as possible? Such is not according to the usual custom of their race." Michael Strogoff no longer doubted that the expressions he had heard had proceeded from this tawny group, and had been exchanged between the old gypsy and the woman to whom he gave the Mongolian name of Sangar. Michael involuntarily moved toward the gangway, as the Bohemian troop was leaving the steamboat. The old Bohemian was there, in a humble attitude, little conformable with the effrontery natural to his race. One would have said that he was endeavoring rather to avoid attention than to attract it. His battered hat, browned by the suns of every clime, was pulled forward over his wrinkled face. His arched back was bent under an old cloak, wrapped closely round him, notwithstanding the heat. It would have been difficult, in this miserable dress, to judge of either his size or face. Near him was the Tsigani, Sangar, a woman about 30 years old. She was tall and well-made, with olive complexion, magnificent eyes, and golden hair. Many of the young dancers were remarkably pretty, all possessing the clear-cut features of their race. These Tsiganes are generally very attractive, and more than one of the great Russian nobles, who try to vie with the English in eccentricity, has not hesitated to choose his wife from among these gypsy girls. One of them was humming a song of strange rhythm which might be thus rendered: "Glitters brightly the gold in my raven locks streaming, rich coral around my graceful neck gleaming, like a bird of the air through the wide world I roam." The laughing girl continued her song, but Michael Strogoff ceased to listen. It struck him just then that the Tsigani, Sangar, was regarding him with a peculiar gaze, as if to fix his features indelibly in her memory. It was but for a few moments when Sangar herself followed the old man and his troop, who had already left the vessel. "That's a bold gypsy," said Michael to himself. "Could she have recognized me as the man she saw at Nizhny Novgorod? These confounded Tsiganes have the eyes of a cat. They can see in the dark, and that woman there might well know." Michael Strogoff was on the point of following Sangar and the gypsy band, but he stopped. "No," thought he, "no unguarded proceedings. If I were to stop that old fortune-teller and his companions, my incognito would run a risk of being discovered. Besides, now they have landed, before they can pass the frontier, I shall be far beyond it. They may take the route from Kazan to Ishim, but that affords no resources to travelers. Besides, a tarantass, drawn by good Siberian horses, will always go faster than a gypsy cart. Come, friend Korpanov, be easy." By this time, the man and Sangar had disappeared. Kazan is justly called the Gate of Asia, and considered as the center of Siberian and Bokharian commerce, for two roads begin here and lead across the Ural Mountains. Michael Strogoff had very judiciously chosen the one by Perm and Ekaterinburg. It is the great stage road, well supplied with relays kept at the expense of the government, and is prolonged from Ishim to Irkutsk. It is true that a second route, the one of which Michael had just spoken, avoiding the slight detour by Perm, also connects Kazan with Ishim. It is perhaps shorter than the others, but this advantage is much diminished by the absence of post-houses, the bad roads, and lack of villages. Michael Strogoff was right in the choice he had made, and if, as appeared probable, the gypsies should follow the second route from Kazan to Ishim, he had every chance of arriving before them. An hour afterwards the bell rang on board the Caucasus, calling the new passengers and recalling the former ones. It was now 7 o'clock in the morning. The requisite fuel had been received on board. The whole vessel began to vibrate from the effects of the steam. She was ready to start. Passengers going from Kazan to Perm were crowding on the deck. Michael noticed that of the two reporters, Blount alone had rejoined the steamer. Was Alcide Jolivet about to miss his passage? But just as the ropes were being cast off, Jolivet appeared, tearing along. The steamer was already sheering off, the gangway had been drawn onto the quay, but Alcide Jolivet would not stick at such a little thing as that, so, with a bound like a harlequin, he alighted on the deck of the Caucasus almost in his rival's arms.
"I thought the Caucasus was going without you," said the latter.
"Bah!" answered Jolivet. "I should soon have caught you up again, by chartering a boat at my cousin's expense, or by travelling post at 20 kopecks a verst, and on horseback. What could I do? It was so long away from the quay to the telegraph office."
"Have you been to the telegraph office?" asked Harry Blount, biting his lips.
"That's exactly where I have been," answered Jolivet, with his most amiable smile.
"And is it still working to Kolyvan?"
"That I don't know, but I can assure you, for instance, that it is working from Kazan to Paris.
You sent a dispatch to your cousin?"
"With enthusiasm."
"You had learnt then?"
"Look here, little father, as the Russians say," replied Alcide Jolivet. "I'm a good fellow, and I don't wish to keep anything from you. The Tartars, and Feofar Khan at their head, have passed Semipolatinsk, and are descending the Irtysh. Do what you like with that."
What? Such important news, and Harry Blount had not known it? And his rival, who had probably learned it from some inhabitant of Kazan, had already transmitted it to Paris. The English paper was distanced. Harry Blount, crossing his hands behind him, walked off and seated himself in the stern without uttering a word. About 10 o'clock in the morning, the young Livonian, leaving her cabin, appeared on deck. Michael Strogoff went forward and took her hand.
"Look, sister," said he,
leading her to the bows of the Caucasus. The view was indeed well worth seeing. The Caucasus had reached the confluence of the Volga and the Kama. There she would leave the former river, after having descended it for nearly 300 miles, to ascend the latter for a full 300. The Kama was here very wide, and its wooded banks lovely. A few white sails enlivened the sparkling water. The horizon was closed by a line of hills covered with aspens, alders, and sometimes large oaks. But these beauties of nature could not distract the thoughts of the young Livonian even for an instant. She had left her hand in that of her companion, and turning to him,
"At what distance are we from Moscow?" she asked.
900 versts, answered Michael.
900 out of 7,000, murmured the girl.
The bell now announced the breakfast hour. Nadia followed Michael Strogoff to the restaurant. She ate little, and as a poor girl whose means are small would do. Michael thought it best to content himself with the fare which satisfied his companion, and in less than 20 minutes he and Nadia returned on deck. There they seated themselves in the stern, and without preamble, Nadia, lowering her voice to be heard by him alone, began.
"Brother, I am the daughter of an exile. My name is Nadia Fedor. My mother died at Riga scarcely a month ago, and I am going to Irkutsk to rejoin my father and share his exile."
"I too am going to Irkutsk," answered Michael, "and I shall thank heaven if it enables me to give Nadia Fedor safe and sound into her father's hands."
"Thank you, brother," replied Nadia.
Michael Strogoff then added that he had obtained a special podorojna for Siberia, and that the Russian authorities could in no way hinder his progress. Nadia asked nothing more. She saw in this fortunate meeting with Michael a means only of accelerating her journey to her father.
"I had," said she, "a permit which authorized me to go to Irkutsk, but the new order annulled that. And but for you, brother, I should have been unable to leave the town, in which, without doubt, I should have perished."
"And dared you alone, Nadia," said Michael, "attempt to cross the steppes of Siberia?"
"The Tartar invasion was not known when I left Riga. It was only at Moscow that I learnt the news."
"And despite it, you continued your journey?"
"It was my duty."
The words showed the character of the brave girl. She then spoke of her father, Vasily Fedor. He was a much esteemed physician at Riga, but his connection with some secret society having been asserted, he received orders to start for Irkutsk. The police who brought the order conducted him without delay beyond the frontier. Vasily Fedor had but time to embrace his sick wife and his daughter, so soon to be left alone, when, shedding bitter tears, he was led away. A year and a half after her husband's departure, Madame Fedor died in the arms of her daughter, who was thus left alone and almost penniless. Nadia Fedor then asked, and easily obtained from the Russian government, an authorization to join her father at Irkutsk. She wrote and told him that she was starting. She had barely enough money for this long journey, and yet she did not hesitate to undertake it. She would do what she could. God would do the rest. End of Book 1, Chapter 8. Book 1, Chapter 9 of Michael Strogoff, Courier of the Tsar. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Michael Strogoff by Jules Verne. Book 1, Chapter 9. Day and Night in a Tarantass. The next day, the 19th of July, the Caucasus reached Perm, the last place at which she touched on the Kama. The government of which Perm is the capital is one of the largest in the Russian Empire, and extending over the Ural Mountains, encroaches on Siberian territory. Marble quarries, mines of salt, platina, gold, and coal are worked here on a large scale. Although Perm, by its situation, has become an important town, it is by no means attractive, being extremely dirty and without resources. This want of comfort is of no consequence to those going to Siberia, for they come from the more civilized districts and are supplied with all necessaries. At Perm, travelers from Siberia resell their vehicles, more or less damaged by the long journey across the plains. There, too, those passing from Europe to Asia purchase carriages or sleighs in the winter season. Michael Strogoff had already sketched out his program. A vehicle carrying the mail usually runs across the Ural Mountains, but this, of course, was discontinued. Even if it had not been so, he would not have taken it, as he wished to travel as fast as possible, without depending on anyone. He wisely preferred to buy a carriage, and journey by stages, simulating the zeal of the postilions by well-applied navodku, or tips. Unfortunately, in consequence of the measures taken against foreigners of Asiatic origin, a large number of travelers had already left Perm, and therefore conveyances were extremely rare. Michael was obliged to content himself with what had been rejected by others. As to horses, as long as the Tsar's courier was not in Siberia, he could exhibit his podorojna, and the postmasters would give him the preference. But, once out of Europe, he had to depend alone on the power of his rubles. But to what sort of a vehicle should he harness his horses? To a telga or to a tarantass? The telga is nothing but an open four-wheeled cart, made entirely of wood, the pieces fastened together by means of strong rope. Nothing could be more primitive, nothing could be less comfortable, but, on the other hand, should any accident happen on the way, nothing could be more easily repaired. There is no want of firs on the Russian frontier, and axle trees grow naturally in forests. The post extraordinary, known by the name of Perkladnoy, is carried by the telga, as any road is good enough for it. It must be confessed that sometimes the ropes which fasten the concern together break, and whilst the hinder part remains stuck in some bog, the fore part arrives at the post-house on two wheels, but this result is considered quite satisfactory. Michael Strogoff would have been obliged to employ a telga if he had not been lucky enough to discover a tarantass. It is to be hoped that the invention of Russian coach-builders will devise some improvement in this last-named vehicle. Springs are wanting in it as well as in the telga. In the absence of iron, wood is not spared, but its four wheels, with 8 or 9 feet between them, assure a certain equilibrium over the jolting rough roads. A splashboard protects the travelers from the mud, and a strong leathern hood, which may be pulled quite over the occupiers, shelters them from the great heat and violent storms of the summer. The tarantass is as solid and as easy to repair as the telga, and is, moreover, less addicted to leaving its hinder part in the middle of the road. It was not without careful search that Michael managed to discover this tarantass, and there was probably not a second to be found in all Perm. He haggled long about the price, for form's sake, to act up to his part as Nicholas Korpanov, a plain merchant of Irkutsk. Nadia had followed her companion in his search after a suitable vehicle. Although the object of each was different, both were equally anxious to arrive at their goal. One would have said the same will animated them both.
"Sister," said Michael, "I wish I could have found a more comfortable conveyance for you."
"Do you say that to me, brother, when I would have gone on foot, if need were, to rejoin my father?"
"I do not doubt your courage, Nadia, but there are physical fatigues a woman may be unable to endure."
"I shall endure them, whatever they be," replied the girl. "If you ever hear a complaint from me, you may leave me in the road and continue your journey alone."
Half an hour later, the Podorojna being presented by Michael, three post-horses were harnessed to the tarantass. These animals, covered with long hair, were very like long-legged bears. They were small but spirited, being of Siberian breed. The way in which the yemshik harnessed them was thus. One, the largest, was secured between two long shafts, on whose farther end was a hoop carrying tassels and bells. The two others were simply fastened by ropes to the steps of the tarantass. This was the complete harness, with mere strings for reins. Neither Michael Strogoff nor the young Livonian girl had any baggage. The rapidity with which one wished to make the journey, and the more than modest resources of the other, prevented them from embarrassing themselves with packages. It was a fortunate thing, under the circumstances, for the tarantass could not have carried both baggage and travellers. It was only made for two persons, without counting the yemshik, who kept his equilibrium on the narrow seat in a marvellous manner. The yemshik is changed at every relay. The man who drove the tarantass during the first stage was, like his horses, a Siberian, and no less shaggy than they, long hair, cut square on the forehead, hat with a turned-up brim, red belt, coat with crossed facings and buttons stamped with the imperial cipher. The yemshik, on coming up with his team, threw an inquisitive glance at the passengers of the tarantass. No luggage? And had there been, where in the world could he have stowed it? Rather shabby in appearance, too. He looked contemptuous.
"Crows,"
said he, without caring whether he was overheard or not.
"Crows, at 6 kopecks a verst."
"No, eagles," said Michael, who understood the yemshik's slang perfectly. "Eagles, do you hear? At 9 kopecks a verst, and a tip besides."
He was answered by a merry crack of the whip. In the language of the Russian postilions, the crow is the stingy or poor traveller, who at the post-houses only pays 2 or 3 kopecks a verst for the horses. The eagle is the traveller who does not mind expense, to say nothing of liberal tips. Therefore, the crow could not claim to fly as rapidly as the imperial bird. Nadia and Michael immediately took their places in the tarantass. A small store of provisions was put in the box, in case at any time they were delayed in reaching the post-houses, which are very comfortably provided under the direction of the state. The hood was pulled up, as it was insupportably hot, and at 12 o'clock the tarantass left Perm in a cloud of dust. The way in which the yemshik kept up the pace of his team would have certainly astonished travellers who, being neither Russians nor Siberians, were not accustomed to this sort of thing. The leader, rather larger than the others, kept to a steady long trot, perfectly regular, whether up or down hill. The two other horses seemed to know no other pace than the gallop, though they performed many an eccentric curvet as they went along. The yemshik, however, never touched them, only urging them on by startling cracks of his whip. But what epithets he lavished on them, including the names of all the saints in the calendar, when they behaved like docile and conscientious animals! The string which served as reins would have had no influence on the spirited beasts, but the words "Na pravo" to the right, "Na levo" to the left, pronounced in a guttural tone, were more effectual than either bridle or snaffle. And what amiable expressions!
"Go on, my doves," the yemshik would say. "Go on, pretty swallows. Fly, my little pigeons. Hold up, my cousin on the left. Gee up, my little father on the right."
But when the pace slackened, what insulting expressions, instantly understood by the sensitive animals!
"Go on, you wretched snail. Confound you, you slug. I'll roast you alive, you tortoise, you."
Whether or not it was from this way of driving, which requires the yemshiks to possess strong throats more than muscular arms, the tarantass flew along at a rate of from 12 to 14 miles an hour. Michael Strogoff was accustomed both to the sort of vehicle and the mode of traveling. Neither jerks nor jolts incommoded him. He knew that a Russian driver never even tries to avoid either stones, ruts, bogs, fallen trees, or trenches, which may happen to be in the road. He was used to all that. His companion ran a risk of being hurt by the violent jolts of the tarantass, but she would not complain. For a little while Nadia did not speak. Then, possessed with the one thought, that of reaching her journey's end, "I have calculated that there are 300 versts between Perm and Ekaterinburg, brother," said she. "Am I right?"
"You are quite right, Nadia," answered Michael, "and when we have reached Ekaterinburg, we shall be at the foot of the Ural Mountains on the opposite side."
"How long will it take to get across the mountains?"
48 hours, for we shall travel day and night. "I say day and night, Nadia," added he, "for I cannot stop even for a moment. I go on without rest to Irkutsk."
"I shall not delay you, brother, no, not even for an hour, and we will travel day and night."
"Well then, Nadia, if the Tartar invasion has only left the road open, we shall arrive in 20 days.
"You have made this journey before?" asked Nadia.
"Many times."
"During winter we should have gone more rapidly and surely, should we not?"
"Yes, especially with more rapidity, but you would have suffered much from the frost and snow."
"What matter? Winter is the friend of Russia."
"Yes, Nadia, but what a constitution anyone must have to endure such friendship. I have often seen the temperature in the Siberian steppes fall to more than 40 degrees below freezing point. I have felt, notwithstanding my reindeer coat, my heart growing chill, my limbs stiffening, my feet freezing in triple woolen socks. I have seen my sleigh horses covered with a coating of ice, their breath congealed at their nostrils. I have seen the brandy in my flask change into hard stone, on which not even my knife could make an impression. But my sleigh flew like the wind, not an obstacle on the plain, white and level, farther than the eye could reach. No rivers to stop one, hard ice everywhere, the route open, the road sure. But at the price of what suffering, Nadia, those alone could say, who have never returned, but whose bodies have been covered up by the snowstorm."
"However, you have returned, brother," said Nadia.
"Yes, but I am a Siberian, and when quite a child, I used to follow my father to the chase, and so became inured to these hardships. But when you said to me, Nadia, that winter would not have stopped you, that you would have gone alone, ready to struggle against the frightful Siberian climate, I seemed to see you lost in the snow and falling, never to rise again."
"How many times have you crossed the steppe in winter?" asked the young Livonian.
3 times, Nadia, when I was going to Omsk."
"And what were you going to do at Omsk?"
"See my mother, who was expecting me."
"And I am going to Irkutsk, where my father expects me. I am taking him my mother's last words. That is as much as to tell you, brother, that nothing would have prevented me from setting out."
"You are a brave girl, Nadia," replied Michael. "God himself would have led you."
All day the tarantass was driven rapidly by the yemshiks, who succeeded each other at every stage. The eagles of the mountain would not have found their name dishonored by these eagles of the highway. The high price paid for each horse, and the tips dealt out so freely, recommended the travelers in a special way. Perhaps the postmasters thought it singular that, after the publication of the order, a young man and his sister, evidently both Russians, could travel freely across Siberia, which was closed to everyone else, but their papers were all en règle, and they had the right to pass. However, Michael Strogoff and Nadia were not the only travelers on their way from Perm to Ekaterinburg. At the first stages, the courier of the Tsar had learnt that a carriage preceded them, but as there was no want of horses, he did not trouble himself about that. During the day, halts were made for food alone. At the post-houses could be found lodging and provision. Besides, if there was not an inn, the house of the Russian peasant would have been no less hospitable. In the villages, which are almost all alike, with their white-walled, green-roofed chapels, the traveler might knock at any door and it would be opened to him. The mujik would come out, smiling and extending his hand to his guest. He would offer him bread and salt. The burning charcoal would be put into the samovar, and he would be made quite at home. The family would turn out themselves rather than that he should not have room. The stranger is the relation of all. He is one sent by God. On arriving that evening, Michael instinctively asked the postmaster how many hours ago the carriage which preceded them had passed that stage.
2 hours ago, little father, replied the postmaster.
Is it a Berlin?
No, a Telga.
How many travelers?
2.
And they are going fast?
Eagles.
Let them put the horses to as soon as possible. Michael and Nadia, resolved not to stop even for an hour, traveled all night. The weather continued fine, though the atmosphere was heavy and becoming charged with electricity. It was to be hoped that a storm would not burst whilst they were among the mountains, for there it would be terrible. Being accustomed to read atmospheric signs, Michael Strogoff knew that a struggle of the elements was approaching. The night passed without incident. Notwithstanding the jolting of the tarantass, Nadia was able to sleep for some hours. The hood was partly raised so as to give as much air as there was in the stifling atmosphere. Michael kept awake all night, mistrusting the yemshiks, who are apt to sleep at their posts. Not an hour was lost at the relays, not an hour on the road. The next day, the 20th of July, at about 8 o'clock in the morning, they caught the first glimpse of the Ural Mountains in the east. This important chain which separates Russia from Siberia was still at a great distance, and they could not hope to reach it until the end of the day. The passage of the mountains must necessarily be performed during the next night. The sky was cloudy all day, and the temperature was therefore more bearable, but the weather was very threatening. It would perhaps have been more prudent not to have ascended the mountains during the night, and Michael would not have done so, had he been permitted to wait. But when, at the last stage, the yemshik drew his attention to a peal of thunder reverberating among the rocks, he merely said, "Is a Telga still before us?"
"Yes."
"How long is it in advance?"
"Nearly an hour."
"Forward, and a triple tip if we are at Ekaterinburg tomorrow morning." End of Book 1, Chapter 9. Book 1, Chapter 10 of Michael Strogoff, Courier of the Tsar. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Michael Strogoff by Jules Verne. Book 1, Chapter 10. A Storm in the Ural Mountains. The Ural Mountains extend in a length of over 2,000 miles between Europe and Asia. Whether they are called the Urals, which is the Tartar, or the Poyas, which is the Russian name, they are correctly so termed, for these names signify belt in both languages. Rising on the shores of the Arctic Sea, they reach the borders of the Caspian. This was the barrier to be crossed by Michael Strogoff before he could enter Siberian Russia. The mountains could be crossed in one night if no accident happened. Unfortunately, thunder muttering in the distance announced that a storm was at hand. The electric tension was such that it could not be dispersed without a tremendous explosion, which in the peculiar state of the atmosphere would be very terrible. Michael took care that his young companion should be as well protected as possible. The hood, which might have been easily blown away, was fastened more securely with ropes, crossed above and at the back. The traces were doubled, and as an additional precaution, the nave boxes were stuffed with straw, as much to increase the strength of the wheels as to lessen the jolting, unavoidable on a dark night. Lastly, the fore and hinder parts, connected simply by the axles to the body of the tarantass, were joined one to the other by a crossbar, fixed by means of pins and screws. Nadia resumed her place in the cart, and Michael took his seat beside her. Before the lowered hood hung two leathern curtains, which would in some degree protect the travellers against the wind and rain. Two great lanterns, suspended from the yemshik's seat, threw a pale glimmer scarcely sufficient to light the way, but serving as warning lights to prevent any other carriage from running into them. It was well that all these precautions were taken, in expectation of a rough night. The road led them up towards dense masses of clouds, and should the clouds not soon resolve into rain, the fog would be such that the tarantass would be unable to advance without danger of falling over some precipice.
The Ural chain does not attain any very great height, the highest summit not being more than 5,000 feet. Eternal snow is there unknown, and what is piled up by the Siberian winter is soon melted by the summer sun. Shrubs and trees grow to a considerable height. The iron and copper mines, as well as those of precious stones, draw a considerable number of workmen to that region. Also, those villages termed Gavodi are there met with pretty frequently, and the road through the great passes is easily practicable for post-carriages. But what is easy enough in fine weather and broad daylight offers difficulties and perils when the elements are engaged in fierce warfare, and the traveler is in the midst of it. Michael Strogoff knew from former experience what a storm in the mountains was, and perhaps this would be as terrible as the snowstorms which burst forth with such vehemence in the winter. Rain was not yet falling, so Michael raised the leathern curtains which protected the interior of the tarantass and looked out, watching the sides of the road, peopled with fantastic shadows, caused by the wavering light of the lanterns. Nadia, motionless, her arms folded, gazed forth also, though without leaning forward, whilst her companion, his body half out of the carriage, examined both sky and earth. The calmness of the atmosphere was very threatening, the air being perfectly still. It was just as if nature were half stifled, and could no longer breathe, her lungs, that is to say those gloomy, dense clouds, not being able to perform their functions. The silence would have been complete but for the grindings of the wheels of the tarantass over the road, the creaking of the axles, the snorting of the horses, and the clattering of their iron hoofs among the pebbles, sparks flying out on every side. The road was perfectly deserted. The tarantass encountered neither pedestrians nor horsemen, nor a vehicle of any description, in the narrow defiles of the Ural, on this threatening night. Not even the fire of a charcoal burner was visible in the woods, not an encampment of miners near the mines, not a hut among the brushwood. Under these peculiar circumstances it might have been allowable to postpone the journey till the morning. Michael Strogoff, however, had not hesitated. He had no right to stop, but then, and it began to cause him some anxiety, what possible reason could those travelers in the telga ahead have for being so imprudent? Michael remained thus on the lookout for some time. About 11 o'clock lightning began to blaze continuously in the sky. The shadows of huge pines appeared and disappeared in the rapid light. Sometimes when the tarantass neared the side of the road, deep gulfs, lit up by the flashes, could be seen yawning beneath them. From time to time, on their vehicle giving a worse lurch than usual, they knew that they were crossing a bridge of roughly hewn planks thrown over some chasm, thunder appearing actually to be rumbling below them. Besides this, a booming sound filled the air, which increased as they mounted higher. With these different noises rose the shouts of the yemshik, sometimes scolding, sometimes coaxing his poor beasts, who were suffering more from the oppression of the air than the roughness of the roads. Even the bells on the shafts could no longer rouse them, and they stumbled every instant. "At what time shall we reach the top of the ridge?" asked Michael of the yemshik.
"At 1 o'clock in the morning, if we ever get there at all," replied he, with a shake of his head.
"Why, my friend, this will not be your first storm in the mountains, will it?"
"No, and pray God it may not be my last."
"Are you afraid?"
"No, I'm not afraid, but I repeat that I think you were wrong in starting."
"I should have been still more wrong had I stayed."
"Hold up, my pigeons," cried the yemshik.
It was his business to obey, not to question. Just then a distant noise was heard, shrill whistling through the atmosphere, so calm a minute before. By the light of a dazzling flash, almost immediately followed by a tremendous clap of thunder, Michael could see huge pines on a high peak bending before the blast. The wind was unchained, but as yet it was the upper air alone which was disturbed. Successive crashes showed that many of the trees had been unable to resist the burst of the hurricane. An avalanche of shattered trunks swept across the road and dashed over the precipice on the left, 200 feet in front of the tarantass. The horses stopped short.
"Get up, my pretty doves!" cried the yemshik,
adding the cracking of his whip to the rumbling of the thunder. Michael took Nadia's hand.
"Are you asleep, sister?" No, brother. Be ready for anything. Here comes the storm.
I am ready.
Michael Strogoff had only just time to draw the leathern curtains when the storm was upon them. The yemshik leapt from his seat and seized the horses' heads, for terrible danger threatened the whole party. The tarantass was at a standstill at a turning of the road, down which swept the hurricane. It was absolutely necessary to hold the animals' heads to the wind, for if the carriage was taken broadside, it must infallibly capsize and be dashed over the precipice. The frightened horses reared, and their driver could not manage to quiet them. His friendly expressions had been succeeded by the most insulting epithets. Nothing was of any use. The unfortunate animals, blinded by the lightning, terrified by the incessant peals of thunder, threatened every instant to break their traces and flee. The yemshik had no longer any control over his team. At that moment, Michael Strogoff threw himself from the tarantass and rushed to his assistance. Endowed with more than common strength, he managed, though not without difficulty, to master the horses. The storm now raged with redoubled fury. A perfect avalanche of stones and trunks of trees began to roll down the slope above them.
"We cannot stop here," said Michael. "We cannot stop anywhere," returned the yemshik, all his energies apparently overcome by terror. "The storm will soon send us to the bottom of the mountain, and that by the shortest way." "Take you that horse, coward," returned Michael. "I'll look after this one."
A fresh burst of the storm interrupted him. The driver and he were obliged to crouch upon the ground to avoid being blown down. The carriage, notwithstanding their efforts and those of the horses, was gradually blown back, and had it not stopped by the trunk of a tree, it would have gone over the edge of the precipice.
"Do not be afraid, Nadia," cried Michael Strogoff.
"I'm not afraid," replied the young Livonian, her voice not betraying the slightest emotion.
The rumbling of the thunder ceased for an instant. The terrible blast had swept past into the gorge below.
"Will you go back?"
said the yemshik.
"No, we must go on. Once past this turning, we shall have the shelter of the slope."
"But the horses won't move."
"Do as I do, and drag them on."
"The storm will come back."
"Do you mean to obey?"
"Do you order it?"
"The Father orders it," answered Michael,
for the first time invoking the all-powerful name of the Emperor.
"Forward, my swallows!"
cried the yemshik, seizing one horse, while Michael did the same to the other. Thus urged, the horses began to struggle onward. They could no longer rear, and the middle horse, not being hampered by the others, could keep in the center of the road. It was with the greatest difficulty that either man or beasts could stand against the wind, and for every three steps they took in advance, they lost one, and even two, by being forced backwards. They slipped, they fell, they got up again. The vehicle ran a great risk of being smashed. If the hood had not been securely fastened, it would have been blown away long before. Michael Strogoff and the yemshik took more than 2 hours in getting up this bit of road, only half a verst in length, so directly exposed was it to the lashing of the storm. The danger was not only from the wind which battered against the travelers, but from the avalanche of stones and broken trunks which were hurtling through the air. Suddenly, during a flash of lightning, one of these masses was seen crashing and rolling down the mountain towards the tarantass. The yemshik uttered a cry. Michael Strogoff in vain brought his whip down on the team. They refused to move. A few feet farther on, and the mass would pass behind them. Michael saw the tarantass struck, his companion crushed. He saw there was no time to drag her from the vehicle. Then, possessed in this hour of peril with superhuman strength, he threw himself behind it, and planting his feet on the ground, by main force placed it out of danger. The enormous mass, as it passed, grazed his chest, taking away his breath as though it had been a cannonball, then crushing to powder the flints on the road, it bounded into the abyss below.
"Oh, brother!"
cried Nadia, who had seen it all by the light of the flashes.
"Nadia," replied Michael, "fear nothing."
"It is not on my own account that I fear."
"God is with us, sister."
"With me, truly, brother, since he has sent thee in my way," murmured the young girl.
The impetus the tarantass had received was not to be lost, and the tired horses once more moved forward. Dragged, so to speak, by Michael and the yemshik, they toiled on towards a narrow pass,
lying north and south, where they would be protected from the direct sweep of the tempest. At one end a huge rock jutted out, round the summit of which whirled an eddy. Behind the shelter of the rock there was a comparative calm, yet once within the circumference of the cyclone, neither man nor beast could resist its power. Indeed, some firs which towered above this protection were in a trice shorn of their tops, as though a gigantic scythe had swept across them. The storm was now at its height. The lightning filled the defile, and the thunderclaps had become one continued peal. The ground, struck by the concussion, trembled as though the whole Ural chain was shaken to its foundations. Happily, the tarantass could be so placed that the storm might strike it obliquely, but the countercurrents directed towards it by the slope could not be so well avoided, and so violent were they that every instant it seemed as though it would be dashed to pieces. Nadia was obliged to leave her seat, and Michael, by the light of one of the lanterns, discovered an excavation bearing the marks of a miner's pick, where the young girl could rest in safety until they could once more start. Just then, it was 1 o'clock in the morning, the rain began to fall in torrents, and this, in addition to the wind and lightning, made the storm truly frightful. To continue the journey at present was utterly impossible. Besides, having reached this pass, they had only to descend the slopes of the Ural Mountains, and to descend now, with the road torn up by a thousand mountain torrents, in these eddies of wind and rain, was utter madness. "To wait is indeed serious," said Michael, "but it must certainly be done, to avoid still longer detentions. The very violence of the storm makes me hope that it will not last long. About 3 o'clock the day will begin to break, and the descent, which we cannot risk in the dark, we shall be able, if not with ease, at least without such danger, to attempt after sunrise." "Let us wait, brother," replied Nadia. "But if you delay, let it not be to spare me fatigue or danger." "Nadia, I know that you are ready to brave everything, but in exposing both of us, I risk more than my life, more than yours. I am not fulfilling my task, that duty which before everything else I must accomplish." "A duty!" murmured Nadia. Just then a bright flash lit up the sky. A loud clap followed. The air was filled with sulphurous, suffocating vapor, and a clump of huge pines, struck by the electric fluid, scarcely 20 feet from the tarantass, flared up like a gigantic torch. The yemshik was struck to the ground by a countershock, but, regaining his feet, found himself happily unhurt. Just as the last growlings of the thunder were lost in the recesses of the mountain, Michael felt Nadia's hand pressing his, and he heard her whisper these words in his ear. "Cries, brother! Listen!" End of Book 1, Chapter 10. Book 1, Chapter 11 of Michael Strogoff, Courier of the Tsar. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Michael Strogoff by Jules Verne. Book 1, Chapter 11. Travelers in Distress. During the momentary lull which followed, shouts could be distinctly heard from farther on, at no great distance from the tarantass. It was an earnest appeal, evidently from some traveler in distress. Michael listened attentively. The yemshik also listened, but shook his head, as though it was impossible to help. "They are travelers calling for aid," cried Nadia.
"They can expect nothing," replied the yemshik.
"Why not?" cried Michael. "Ought we not to do for them what they would for us under similar circumstances?"
"Surely you will not risk the carriage and horses?"
"I will go on foot," replied Michael, interrupting the yemshik.
"I will go too, brother," said the young girl.
"No, remain here, Nadia. The yemshik will stay with you. I do not wish to leave him alone."
"I will stay," replied Nadia.
"Whatever happens, do not leave this spot.
You will find me where I now am."
Michael pressed her hand, and turning the corner of the slope, disappeared in the darkness.
"Your brother is wrong," said the yemshik.
"He is right," replied Nadia simply.
Meanwhile, Strogoff strode rapidly on. If he was in a great hurry to aid the travelers, he was also very anxious to know who it was that had not been hindered from starting by the storm. for he had no doubt that the cries came from the telga, which had so long preceded him. The rain had stopped, but the storm was raging with redoubled fury. The shouts, borne on the air, became more distinct. Nothing was to be seen of the pass in which Nadia remained. The road wound along, and the squalls, checked by the corners, formed eddies highly dangerous, to pass which, without being taken off his legs, Michael had to use his utmost strength. He soon perceived that the travelers whose shouts he had heard were at no great distance. Even then, on account of the darkness, Michael could not see them, yet he heard distinctively their words. This is what he heard, and what caused him some surprise.
"Are you coming back, blockhead? You shall have a taste of the knout at the next stage. Do you hear, you devil's postilion? Hello, below! This is how a carriage takes you in this country? Yes, this is what you call a telga. Oh, that abominable driver! He goes on and does not appear to have discovered that he has left us behind. Do deceive me, too. Me, an honorable Englishman. I will make a complaint at the Chancellor's office and have the fellow hanged."
This was said in a very angry tone, but was suddenly interrupted by a burst of laughter from his companion, who exclaimed,
"Well, this is a good joke, I must say."
"You venture to laugh," said the Briton angrily.
"Certainly, my dear confrère, and that most heartily. Upon my word, I never saw anything to come up to it."
Just then a crashing clap of thunder re-echoed through the defile, and then died away among the distant peaks. When the sound of the last growl had ceased, the merry voice went on,
"Yes, it undoubtedly is a good joke. This machine certainly never came from France."
"Nor from England," replied the other.
On the road, by the light of the flashes, Michael saw, 20 yards from him, 2 travellers, seated side by side in a most peculiar vehicle, the wheels of which were deeply embedded in the ruts formed in the road. He approached them, the one grinning from ear to ear, and the other gloomily contemplating his situation, and recognized them as the 2 reporters who had been his companions on board the Caucasus.
"Good morning to you, sir," cried the Frenchman. "Delighted to see you here. Let me introduce you to my intimate ennemi, Mr. Blount."
The English reporter bowed, and was about to introduce in his turn his companion, Alcide Jolivet, in accordance with the rules of society, when Michael interrupted him.
"Perfectly unnecessary, sir. We already know each other, for we travelled together on the Volga."
"Ah, yes, exactly so, Mr.
Nicholas Korpanov, merchant of Irkutsk. But may I know what happened which, though a misfortune to your companion, amuses you so much?"
"Certainly, Mr. Korpanov," replied Alcide. "Fancy, our driver has gone off with the front part of this confounded carriage, and left us quietly seated in the back part. So here we are, in the worse half of a telga, no driver, no horses. Is it not a joke?"
"No joke at all," said the Englishman.
"Indeed it is, my dear fellow. You do not know how to look on the bright side of things."
"How, pray, are we to go on?" asked Blount.
"That is the easiest thing in the world," replied Alcide. "Go and harness yourself to what remains of our cart. I will take the reins and call you my little pigeon, like a true yamshik, and you will trot off like a real post-horse."
"Mr. Jolivet," replied the Englishman, "this joking is going too far. It passes all limits and..."
"Now, do be quiet, my dear sir. When you are done up, I will take your place, and call me a broken-winded snail and faint-hearted tortoise, if I don't take you over the ground at a rattling pace."
Alcide said all this with such perfect good humour that Michael could not help smiling.
"Gentlemen," said he, "here is a better plan. We have now reached the highest ridge of the Ural chain, and thus have merely to descend the slopes of the mountain. My carriage is close by, only 200 yards behind. I will lend you one of my horses, harness it to the remains of the telga, and tomorrow, if no accident befalls us, we will arrive together at Ekaterinburg."
"That, Mr. Korpanov," said Alcide, "is indeed a generous proposal."
"Indeed, sir," replied Michael, "I would willingly offer you places in my tarantass, but it will only hold 2, and my sister and I already fill it."
"Really, sir," answered Alcide, "with your horse and our demi-telga, we will go to the world's end."
"Sir," said Harry Blount, "we most willingly accept your kind offer. And as to that iemschik..."
"Oh, I assure you that you are not the first travellers who have met with a similar misfortune," replied Michael.
"But why should not our driver come back? He knows perfectly well that he has left us behind, wretch that he is."
He never suspected such a thing."
"What, the fellow not know that he was leaving the better half of his telga behind?"
"Not a bit, and in all good faith is driving the forepart into Ekaterinburg."
"Did I not tell you that it was a good joke, confrère?" cried Alcide.
"Then, gentlemen, if you will follow me," said Michael, "we will return to my carriage, and..."
"But the telga," observed the Englishman.
"There is not the slightest fear that it will fly away, my dear Blount," exclaimed Alcide. "It has taken such good root in the ground that if it were left here until next spring, it would begin to bud."
"Come then, gentlemen," said Michael Strogoff, "and we will bring up the tarantass." The Frenchman and the Englishman, descending from their seats, no longer the hinder one, since the front had taken its departure, followed Michael. Walking along, Alcide Jolivet chattered away as usual, with his invariable good humour.
"Faith, Mr. Korpanov," said he, "you have indeed got us out of a bad scrape."
"I have only done, sir," replied Michael, "what anyone would have done in my place."
"Well, sir, you have done us a good turn, and if you are going farther, we may possibly meet again, and..."
Alcide Jolivet did not put any direct question to Michael as to where he was going, but the latter, not wishing it to be suspected that he had anything to conceal, at once replied, "I am bound for Omsk, gentlemen."
"Mr. Blount and I," replied Alcide, "go where danger is certainly to be found, and without doubt news also."
"To the invaded provinces?" asked Michael with some earnestness.
"Exactly so, Mr. Korpanov, and we may possibly meet there."
"Indeed, sir," replied Michael, "I have little love for cannonballs or lance points, and am by nature too great a lover of peace to venture where fighting is going on."
"I am sorry, sir, extremely sorry. We must only regret that we shall separate so soon. But on leaving Ekaterinburg, it may be a fortunate fate to travel together, if only for a few days."
"Do you go on to Omsk?" asked Michael, after a moment's reflection.
"We know nothing as yet," replied Alcide, "but we shall certainly go as far as Ishim, and once there, our movements must depend on circumstances."
"Well then, gentlemen," said Michael, "we will be fellow travellers as far as Ishim." Michael would certainly have preferred to travel alone, but he could not, without appearing at least singular, seek to separate himself from the two reporters, who were taking the same road that he was. Besides, since Alcide and his companion intended to make some stay at Ishim, he thought it rather convenient than otherwise to make that part of the journey in their company. Then, in an indifferent tone, he asked, "Do you know, with any certainty, where this Tartar invasion is?"
"Indeed, sir," replied Alcide, "we only know what they said at Perm. Feofar Khan's Tartars have invaded the whole province of Semipolatinsk, and for some days, by forced marches, have been descending the Irtysh. You must hurry if you wish to get to Omsk before them."
"Indeed I must," replied Michael.
"It is reported also that Colonel Ogareff has succeeded in passing the frontier in disguise, and that he may not be slow in joining the Tatar chief in their revolted country."
"But how do they know it?" asked Michael, whom this news, more or less true, so directly concerned.
"Oh, as these things are always known," replied Alcide, "it is in the air."
"Then have you really reason to think that Colonel Ogareff is in Siberia?"
"I myself have heard it said that he was to take the road from Kazan to Ekaterinburg."
"Ah, you know that, Mr. Jolivet?"
said Harry Blount, roused from his silence.
"I knew it," replied Alcide.
"And do you know that he went disguised as a gypsy?" asked Blount.
"As a gypsy?" exclaimed Michael, almost involuntarily, and he suddenly remembered the look of the old Bohemian at Nizhny Novgorod, his voyage on board the Caucasus, and his disembarking at Kazan.
"Just well enough to make a few remarks on the subject in a letter to my cousin," replied Alcide, smiling. "You lost no time at Kazan," dryly observed the Englishman. "No, my dear fellow, and while the Caucasus was laying in her supply of fuel, I was employed in obtaining a store of information."
Michael no longer listened to the repartee which Harry Blount and Alcide exchanged. He was thinking of the gypsy troupe, of the old Tsigani, whose face he had not been able to see, and of the strange woman who accompanied him, and then of the peculiar glance which she had cast at him. Suddenly, close by, he heard a pistol shot.
"Ah, forward, sirs!" cried he.
"Hello," said Alcide to himself. "This quiet merchant who always avoids bullets is in a great hurry to go where they are flying about just now."
Quickly followed by Harry Blount, who was not a man to be behind in danger, he dashed after Michael. In another instant the three were opposite the projecting rock which protected the tarantass at the turning of the road. The clump of pines struck by the lightning was still burning. There was no one to be seen. However, Michael was not mistaken. Suddenly a dreadful growling was heard, and then another report.
"A bear!" cried Michael, who could not mistake the growling. "Nadia! Nadia!"
And drawing his cutlass from his belt, Michael bounded round the buttress behind which the young girl had promised to wait. The pines, completely enveloped in flames, threw a wild glare on the scene. As Michael reached the tarantass, a huge animal retreated towards him. It was a monstrous bear. The tempest had driven it from the woods, and it had come to seek refuge in this cave, doubtless its habitual retreat, which Nadia then occupied. Two of the horses, terrified at the presence of the enormous creature, breaking their traces, had escaped, and the iemschik, thinking only of his beasts, leaving Nadia face to face with the bear, had gone in pursuit of them. But the brave girl had not lost her presence of mind. The animal, which had not at first seen her, was attacking the remaining horse. Nadia, leaving the shelter in which she had been crouching, had run to the carriage, taken one of Michael's revolvers, and advancing resolutely toward the bear, had fired close to it. The animal, slightly wounded in the shoulder, turned on the girl, who rushed for protection behind the tarantass, but then, seeing that the horse was attempting to break its traces, and knowing that if it did so, and the others were not recovered, their journey could not be continued, with the most perfect coolness she again approached the bear, and as it raised its paws to strike her down, gave it the contents of the second barrel. This was the report which Michael had just heard. In an instant he was on the spot. Another bound, and he was between the bear and the girl. His arm made one movement upwards, and the enormous beast, ripped up by that terrible knife, fell to the ground, a lifeless mass. He had executed in splendid style the famous blow of the Siberian hunters, who endeavor not to damage the precious fur of the bear, which fetches a high price.
"You are not wounded, sister," said Michael, springing to the side of the young girl.
"No, brother," replied Nadia.
At that moment the two journalists came up. Alcide seized the horse's head, and in an instant his strong wrist mastered it. His companion and he had seen Michael's rapid stroke.
"Bravo!" cried Alcide. "For a simple merchant, Mr. Korpanoff, you handle the hunter's knife in a most masterly fashion."
"Most masterly indeed," added Blount.
"In Siberia," replied Michael, "we are obliged to do a little of everything."
Alcide regarded him attentively. Seen in the bright glare, his knife dripping with blood, his tall figure, his foot firm on the huge carcass, he was indeed worth looking at.
"A formidable fellow," said Alcide to himself.
Then, advancing respectfully, he saluted the young girl. Nadia bowed slightly. Alcide turned towards his companion.
"The sister worthy of the brother," said he.
"Now, were I a bear, I should not meddle with two so brave and so charming."
Harry Blount, perfectly upright, stood hat in hand at some distance. His companion's easy manners only increased his usual stiffness. At that moment the iemschik, who had succeeded in recapturing his two horses, reappeared. He cast a regretful glance at the magnificent animal lying on the ground, loath to leave it to the birds of prey, and then proceeded once more to harness his team. Michael acquainted him with the traveller's situation, and his intention of loaning one of the horses.
"As you please," replied the iemschik. "Only, you know, two carriages instead of one."
"All right, my friend," said Alcide, who understood the insinuation. "We will pay double."
"Then gee up, my turtle-doves," cried the iemschik.
Nadia again took her place in the tarantass. Michael and his companions followed on foot. It was 3 o'clock. The storm still swept with terrific violence across the defile. When the first streaks of daybreak appeared, the tarantass had reached the telga, which was still conscientiously embedded as far as the center of the wheel. Such being the case, it can be easily understood how a sudden jerk would separate the front from the hinder part. One of the horses was now harnessed by means of cords to the remains of the telga. The reporters took their place on the singular equipage, and the two carriages started off. They had now only to descend the Ural slopes, in doing which there was not the slightest difficulty. 6 hours afterwards, the two vehicles, the tarantass preceding the telga, arrived at Ekaterinburg, nothing worthy of note having happened in the descent. The first person the reporters perceived at the door of the post-house was their Yemshik, who appeared to be waiting for them. This worthy Russian had a fine open countenance, and he smilingly approached the travellers, and holding out his hand, in a quiet tone he demanded the usual pourboire. This very cool request roused Blount's ire to its highest pitch, and had not the Yemshik prudently retreated, a straight-out blow of the fist in true British boxing style would have paid his claim of navodku. Alcide Jolivet, at this burst of anger, laughed as he had never laughed before. "But the poor devil is quite right," he cried. "He is perfectly right, my dear fellow. It is not his fault if we did not know how to follow him." Then, drawing several kopecks from his pocket, "Here, my friend," said he, handing them to the Yemshik, "take them. If you have not earned them, it is not your fault." This redoubled Mr. Blount's irritation. He even began to speak of a lawsuit against the owner of the telga. "A lawsuit in Russia, my dear fellow!" cried Alcide. "Things must indeed change should it ever be brought to a conclusion. Did you never hear the story of the wet nurse who claimed payment of 12 months' nursing of some poor little infant?" "I never heard it," replied Harry Blount. "Then you do not know what that suckling had become by the time judgment was given in favour of the nurse. What was he, pray?" "Colonel of the Imperial Guard." At this reply, all burst into a laugh. Alcide, enchanted with his own joke, drew out his notebook, and in it wrote the following memorandum, destined to figure in a forthcoming French and Russian dictionary: "Telga, a Russian carriage with 4 wheels, that is, when it starts, with 2 wheels when it arrives at its destination." End of Book 1, Chapter 11.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
Menards is your electrical headquarters. We carry all the tools and testers you need for any electrical job. Stack up your toolbox with Southwire electrical products today. Right now, save big money on Southwire electrical tools, testers, cable ties, wire, and cable. Shop our huge selection in-store at Menards. Ranked number one in customer satisfaction among home improvement retailers according to J.D. Power. For more information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Save big.